Good morning, and what a fine morning it is, right? I think fall finally arrived. That was pretty nice. Welcome to this morning's study session for the Mesa City Council for Thursday, October 10th, 2013. We don't have anyone who's joining us by phone. Would someone want to go outside and call in so we can feel like we're at home? I don't know what to do here. First item on the agenda is to hear a presentation discuss the open meeting law and conflicts of interest, and we're going to turn it over to Ms. Debbie Spinner for that.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. As the Mayor said, we're going to have a presentation on the open meeting law and conflicts of interest statute, kind of as a refresher for most of you and as a presentation for our new council member. We have asked Andrew McGuire to come lead the presentation and the discussion this morning. Andrew works at the law firm of Gust Rosenfeld. He's been a municipal lawyer for many, many years. He is also the city attorney for the towns of Avondale and Fountain Hills. So he's very familiar with the open meeting law and conflicts of interest statute, and I'm going to turn it over to Andrew.
Mayor, members of the council, and as Debbie said, my name's Andrew McGuire. I'm with Gust Rosenfeld, and you've probably seen members of our firm popping through the council chambers periodically. We represent the city on a number of different things, on bond issues, the HPAN statute from last year, and the acceleration work on the freeway. I work with Debbie's office on the open meeting law presentation this time, of course, but also on development impact fees and other various fun things that we come to you and bore you with at council meetings later on. The firm has been working with municipalities since 1921. I'm glad to say that I haven't been doing it quite that long. This is my 19th year in municipal practice, and I'm happy to say that almost every bit of those 19 years has been representing some governmental entity or another. And in this case, with our firm, we represent almost every school district in the state, 7 of the municipalities on a full-time basis, and then we do spot work around the state for just about everybody else. So if the name's familiar, I'm happy about that. If it's not familiar, we're really not doing our job very well. The best part about coming and speaking to this body for me, though, is that I've been a Mesa resident for 22 years now, almost all of which in Councilmember Kavanaugh's district, and I'm about as close to Debbie as you can get without being annoying. I think it might take a 9-iron, maybe a sand wedge, for me to hit her house from mine. So happy to be here to talk with all of you. And
I'm impressed you could actually hit her house with a 9-iron sand wedge. Because I don't care if she was next door neighbors, you know, I'm playing all over the place.
I told her that I would do that because the neighbor between us has a whole family of golfers. And I realized none of them would miss that badly, so she'd know it was me. She threatened to send the helicopter out to find me, though. The presentation today is probably going to be a bit of a retread for some of you. I know that every year the clients we represent, we do an open meeting, conflicts of interest, kind of good government training. We carved out all the good government part of it because most of you are veterans and been here for a while, and we don't need to go over that again. But the open meeting and conflicts of interest portions of this presentation are important to refresh on. And especially when you hear from someone different than the person you hear all the time. I know, like Debbie does, that the council that hears from me every week likes to hear from a fresh face every now and then, because you'll get a slightly different take on it. Hopefully not too much of a different take, because these are fairly standard practices of law. But we'll go through it, and if you have questions along the way, feel free to interrupt me. I really don't mind. I represent city councils all the time, so interruptions in the middle are fine. Or if you want to hold questions to the end, I'm fine with that as well. All right, two things we're going to talk about, just conflicts of interest in the open meeting law. We're going to narrow it to just those two today. Conflicts of interest, in Arizona, the statute, in my mind, is written backwards. It's written as a not this kind of statute. A substantial interest is anything that's not a remote interest, and then there's a definition of a remote interest. Well, the remote interest is also vaguely defined so that anyone who tells you they really thoroughly understand this statute either has no free time and they're spending a lot of time researching it, or they really just haven't read it closely enough to see all the nuances that are in it. The basic rule for me is if it's a pecuniary interest, if you have a money interest in the outcome of a decision, you should have your radar up for conflict of interest. That's the first thing you should hear is there's a money interest in this, I need to be aware of it. What we don't typically think about when we're thinking of conflicts of interest in our regular day-to-day lives, though, that you need to think about under the Arizona law is, what about everybody else I know? What about my family? And the conflict of interest law in Arizona spreads out to a level of family that will surprise you a bit. The obvious ones are your spouse. If your wife or husband is in a business, clearly that shows up. Parents or grandparents, also pretty obvious if there's a family business. Children and grandchildren, a little bit less so. I don't want to date anyone on the council, but there are probably business interests for grandchildren out there for some of us. And brothers and sisters of the whole or half blood, so that we're getting all the blended families as well. But then here's the one that catches most people, is spouses, relatives, and spouses of those folks. So now we're starting to get out to a branch of a tree that's quite a ways out. What it means is you really need to let your city attorney know if you have business interests that are out in those other branches, because she's just not going to know. You know, Debbie's job is to know most of you as well as she can and to understand what you do so that she can flag something if there's a problem. But what she can't do is know what all of your relatives do, and I don't think you really want her to anyway. What do you have to do if you have a conflict of interest? I mean, this one's pretty clear. The statute says you have to declare your conflict. I think it's best to do it before the meeting. I think it's best to do it in writing. And I know that most city councils, it ends up being done verbally at the meeting. All of those are okay. I think best practice is you have a written process. I know not all cities do that. What you need to do, though, after that is what we'll get to. That's the important part after you've declared a conflict. But prior to declaring a conflict, you actually have to remove yourself as soon as you're aware of it. So the declaration is your public announcement that you have a conflict. But if you knew about it prior to that time, you should be out of the discussion, and we'll talk about that here in a minute. The other instance where we see a lot of questions come back our way are on the appearance of impropriety. And this is the one that comes back from members of the public, typically a member of the public that's on the opposite side of the issue than you are. They'll say they shouldn't be voting on that because they live in the area or because they have a reason not to like it. That's an appearance of impropriety question rather than a true conflict under the statute, because if you don't have a monetary interest in it, you don't really have a statutory conflict. After you've announced or become aware of it, you have to refrain from any participation. That means before, during, and after. So if it's beforehand by a long distance, that means you don't talk to staff about it. You don't talk other than the legal staff to tell them about the conflict and get their opinion on it. You don't talk to other council members about it. You know, if you can avoid talking to people in public, but I know that's almost impossible for you all when you're approached. But that's the level that this statute operates at. It's a very high standard. And when conflict cases have come forward, there has been very little sympathy for the I just didn't know approach.
Hey, Andrew, let me ask you something. Appearance of impropriety seems to potentially raise its head like a zoning case. And let's say you own a property or one of your relatives owns a property that's X feet, blocks, whatever, from a zoning case. You know, everybody thinks that every zoning case affects property values. We know that that's not really true, but that's the perception. At what point in time or how do you determine whether a certain action will have that monetary interest on a piece of property? How far does it need to be? How do you make that determination? Is there a time when it's absolutely objectively saying boom? I mean, I can understand it if it's right next door, that's pretty good. But what if it's a half a block away? What if it's more than the 300 feet or something like that? How do you make that determination?
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, it's more of a case by case look at each set of facts determination than we can say. It's definitely not a bright line. The only bright line in a zoning case I could give you is if it's your property. That's a definite bright line. If it's next door to your property, it depends upon what the change is. If the change is in a rear yard setback for an entire zoning category and your property really wouldn't be benefited by that rear yard setback changing, you know, then it's more of a gray area. If you're within the zone of 300 feet, we certainly want to look at it because the statute's already called out that those folks definitely have an interest enough to be able to raise a protest. So we'd want to evaluate it to see what the change was. If it were outside of that zone, it becomes more and more attenuated. Now, there is a case where you would be in a group of landholders who are so few in number that a citywide zoning change might affect you directly, but there really aren't many categories like that in the city. Most of your zoning categories cover hundreds, if not thousands, of properties. And so each time that comes up, raise the question with your city attorney and go through the facts to make sure that you're in one of those, at least not certain areas or in a absolutely clear area.
I mean, you know, I get it where you have to do case by case, but certainly it would seem like if there's a general plan that's approved, and let's say you had a piece of property that is merely changing to conform with the general plan. Let's say it's a county island. This is hypothetical. I do not have a friend or anyone. I'm just wondering because it has come up on occasion. Let's say you had someone who owned a farm, and of course it was ag in the county. It came into the city, but it was general plan for acre lots. I don't know what it would be. And all you're doing is you're changing the zoning to conform with general plan, or it's consistent with general plan, not conform, it's consistent with general plan. Is that considered a change? Because technically, legally, it is a change. You're changing zoning, but you're changing zoning from really a non-conforming zoning to a conforming zoning. I mean, without thinking of a specific case, just generally, is that something that you would really need to look at, or is that thrown into that gray area where, you know, let's look and see exactly what it is?
Mr. Mayor, I think as the way that the Arizona statutes work together, I think that you'd still have that as a look at it category.
Okay.
If we were like California, where a general plan change mandates a zoning conformance change, then I think it probably might fall into the category if you can't really do anything about it anyway, the law requires it to be changed. In this case, though, Arizona has, even with our Growing Smarter amendments, you know, I keep wanting to say it a few years ago, but it's getting to be more than that now. With the Growing Smarter amendments, the conformance standard has changed, but there's still no mandatory trigger.
Gotcha.
So it's still going to be an individualized thing. So if that property were owned by a council member or anybody in the tree of influence that we talked about, that would have to be a conflict that you'd have to disclose and then refrain from participation.
Okay.
Two other things that pop up somewhat uniquely for Mesa, but not necessarily, just because your charter provision is a little bit different, but others have charter provisions that are similar. You have effects on voting for conflicts of interest. They're found in Section 901 of your charter and Section 209. Those are really focused more on telling you more when it is okay to have a conflict of interest and what will happen with your vote if you don't. Other communities have a little more forceful track of that. For instance, the city of Avondale has a provision that if you don't have a conflict of interest under the statute, not even in the appearance of impropriety versions, if there's no true conflict and you don't vote, your vote is recorded as a yes. That could become really strategic in a case where someone decided to abstain from a vote that they just weren't comfortable with, and someone then knew that that was going to be a yes vote. That could change the outcome of a matter. So it's important, and the Avondale Council is aware of that because we pointed out to them that the provision was put into their charter by their voters to make sure people vote on all the important matters. And so your charter is not quite as extreme as that, but it certainly has provisions you need to be cognizant of.
Well, just so everyone knows, what does our charter require?
Our charter states that the council cannot abstain unless you have a conflict. Now, as Andrew said, our ethics code, which is also adopted as part of the charter, says that you should avoid even the appearance of impropriety. So that's where there's a little bit of squishy room there. And we have had council members that maybe legally have not had a conflict of interest under the statute, because of an appearance of impropriety, they have declared a potential conflict. So we've
allowed. But the idea is that you either vote or you declare a conflict.
Right. We have not allowed council to just abstain.
Well, it's not that we.
Our charter
doesn't allow that.
Yeah, our charter says.
You can't vote present or abstain or.
That's correct, Mayor.
That, okay. Councilman Richens.
Can you contrast with how a general law city would work, a non-charter city? I mean, what's kind of the difference? Why do charter cities address it certain ways? Because, you know what I mean?
Yeah. The Mr. Mayor, Councilman Richens, the difference between a general law town or city and a charter city is typically in the restrictions upon the council rather than in more powers upon the council in this area. In other areas, obviously, they're broader powers. Most general law towns and cities operate under just the strict conflict of interest law. They don't have an individualized process for dealing with this. Others who have adopted council rules handle it by rule. Your rules have been drawn up into a much higher level because they've been formally incorporated. The rules in most cases are just a council-adopted document so that they can be changed as the council desires. But many communities have gone to a you don't vote on something you're supposed to vote, it's counted one way or another rule. For instance, Fountain Hills has that kind of provision, much like Avondale's, except their provision says if you don't vote on something for which you didn't have a conflict of interest, you're deemed to have voted with the majority. Yeah, and if there isn't a majority, that's when there's a little spinoff rule on as well. So you'll see variations on that theme. And typically, I will tell you, without besmirching any citizens or communities or anything else that we represent, it is typically in the communities where the citizenry is more active that you will see rules like that appear, or where there's been a great divide of some kind, where one group feels disenfranchised, you will see charter provisions. Avondale's charter provision probably grew out of disenfranchisement out of one group of people or another. Fountain Hills probably grew out of a very active citizenry that wanted to make sure that no one could ever duck a vote. You also have your ethics handbook that you've adopted. You've got a couple of key things in there that I think that are somewhat unique to you. They are parallel to state law, but I think they are good things to have, especially as a resident. I appreciate that. That you have to report gifts from anybody with whom you do business in the city. So that pretty much means anybody. You do business by operating as a council. So anybody who provides you a gift of any kind, even if they're never thinking they're going to appear in front of the council, unless it's a family member and it's your birthday or Christmas or something else, you really should have this in mind. You have to report it very quickly, too, under your provisions. You have 2 days if you're in town. If you're on a trip out of town, if the mayor's in Washington, D.C., the reporting requirement is 2 days after return from that trip. So it's a very short turnaround time, especially if the council is on summer break or some other time. You need to make sure that you're diligent about that. What you need to report is fairly simple. Anything over $50 is an easy one. Gifts related to sporting events, cultural and entertainment events, those are $0 up. Those are everything. And the reason why your ethics policy says that, I'm imagining, is that the state law counterpart to that doesn't make a distinction. It says you cannot take gifts to go to a sporting or athletic event. They call it entertainment, but that includes basically all sporting events and all athletic events, sports of any kind. So those are the areas where we see the most questions and problems, because my firm as well will invite people to go to baseball games or otherwise because you have a good opportunity to sit and chat. Well, if I invited any one of you to the baseball game, you would have to pay the face value of that ticket in advance of that, not afterwards after we thought about it and said, oh, we should have done that. It can't be a gift for which you accept a sporting or entertainment venue. And that clearly was, we used to call it ballet and basketball. It was our joking of reference to it. It was because that's where most of the gifts that went unreported were. And that's why the legislature enacted that provision. What happens if you have a conflict of interest? This is always the interesting question that comes back. Oh.
Maybe can you clear that up on the, like sometimes you get invited to like a charity dinner too, or you get a ticket to go. So are you saying no sports, nothing like that, or do you just have to report that?
Well, there are two things, Mr. Mayor, Councilmember. We've got two different portions of that. You've got your code of ethics, which says you have to report it. You have the state law that has a specific carve out for what I would refer to as more like the professional sporting event things. We've talked about that with council members a lot in terms of what is now, I guess, the Waste Management Open in Scottsdale. That has been a big item because Cox invites every member of every council and every legislator all around the state to go to that event. Now, there is a carve-out for that statute that allows for special events in which everybody in the legislature is invited to them. And we've had some heated debates about whether or not that really applies.
Applies to
an invitation to maybe the seven of you.
Yeah, but apply when you say the legislature, does this state law pointedly toward state elected officials, or are state elected officials defined as any state in, subdivision or entity also applies to that?
It's actually the legislatures who they're referring to,
yeah.
So the state legislature. It's not applied to this level.
Okay.
And I think that it was not an error to omit city and town councils, because to invite seven people is something that's pretty easy to do. To invite 90 is a little more difficult. And I think that was the purpose there, was that if it was a big event, that would be the case. I have heard back from vendors who want to invite the entire council to a different event. And you know, one of my clients happens to have a very large motorsports complex that has annual events.
I've heard of it.
Yeah. We hope so. Although it's misnamed in Avondale's
yeah.
mind. That event, they'll say, well, we're inviting everybody from the legislature so your council can come. I've taken the opinion that, no, that's not an exception. But we've had disagreements about that. My council members understand our opinion on that, and we go from there. We have a number of events like that around the Valley, though, that you'll get invitations to, that the vendor's take on it will be that you have an exception under the all legislature exception because they've invited everybody. I don't know if it reaches to you all. I honestly don't.
So, I don't know, yeah.
I'm still, yeah, yeah. Councilmember Luna.
What if it's something related to the Mesa Arts Center, which is a city facility, some,
yeah.
How does that work?
Most of the time, the distinction that I will make is if you are being invited to something in your role as an elected member to perform a ceremonial or official capacity role, that's fine. If you're being invited as a guest to go enjoy yourself, then that's not fine. Now, the Mesa Arts Center is going to be, for you and for Debbie's interpretation each time, will have to be, what's the event? You know, if you were going to go see a concert that were there and it was a free ticket to a concert that was playing there, that's different than going to, you know, the arts festival that's there to speak on behalf of the city. So I think that's why this area causes the most questions, when we spend most of our time talking about the nuances of it.
So, I mean, I don't know if we're paying you by the word, but I'm not clear still. Pay for tickets or declare tickets? For us, for the Mesa, specifically to us, do we have to pay for the tickets or do we have to declare the tickets?
It depends on which kind of event we're talking about first.
Sports.
So if it's a sports event, under your code, you have to declare it. Under the state law, you have to pay for it.
Okay, does the state law apply to the legislature? Does it apply to our city council?
Yes.
In this instance? Okay, so under the state law, you pay. Under the our thing, you declare. So you're saying both?
Yes.
Thank you.
Oh, I love it when I get that look.
Well, I mean, you know, I we have to look at this a little bit more because... Yep. You know, we are absolutely fanatics about reporting. I think our ethics code, and Councilmember Kavanaugh had a big part of designing that and led the effort on really formulating that. And I think ours should be used really as a model, because when you look at what we report, how we report, the system we have, I feel pretty comfortable about it. And I know that my staff, at least, and I think most every other staff, is very diligent in making sure that those 2 days do not pass. I've had staff members running after me. No, you have to sign this before you leave. When things, even if there's appearance, they're pretty good at doing that. But this is the first I've heard of an interpretation that things that are designed for the legislature extend to every elected official in Arizona.
Now, that's an argument being raised by some, but I don't agree with it.
Okay, well, there are others who have other opinions, like you said, as you do. Okay, so we'll need to look at that a little bit more.
And it just highlights what we'll get to here in another slide, the importance of picking up the phone and calling the city attorney and saying, here's what's being proposed, what do you think? Because you have the additional benefit of having a city attorney who's spent time at the AG's office. And I will tell you that the view of conflicts of interest in the open meeting law from the AG's perspective and most people who don't work there is different. And it's a much more strict and narrow interpretation typically given from folks who come from the AG's office. And I think Debbie has that experience and is useful to you. But the real reason that you want to make sure you do it is what we'll get to at the bottom of the slide. If you are found to have a conflict of interest on any action, the action is voidable by this council. It's not void, as it is in some cases. It's voidable. Because there'll be times where you may find that a council member had a conflict of interest, but it's something important enough to this city that you need to move it forward anyway, even with that conflict. The penalties, though, aren't divorced from that. So you can have a conflict in which the council thinks is voidable, and you don't void it, but the penalties may still be there. If it's a knowing or intentional violation, it's a Class 6 felony, which, you know, that's a severe penalty. That puts you in a position of not being able to vote, not being able to bear arms. You have a number of different things in here that are robbed of you with a felony conviction. And so that's something you don't ever want to be involved in. Reckless or negligent, and again, these are terms that, as Councilmember Kavanaugh will know, and the mayor as well, those are subject to whoever's interpretation is bringing the suit against you. It's a Class 1 misdemeanor. Now, not nearly as severe in terms of long-term effects, but a Class 1 misdemeanor is $2,500 and 6 months in jail per offense is the maximum penalty. And that's not too far off of the penalties in the Class 6 felony. Plus, you forfeit office, but I don't think you really care about it once you get down to there. If you're worrying about a Class 6 felony, I don't think you're worried about public office at that point.
How's forfeiting office considered a penalty? I'm sorry, go ahead. That might be a blessing.
The bottom line is that this statute, because it's so severe, has an absolute out for the seven of you. If you have a question and you pose it to your city attorney and she says, this is not a conflict of interest, and she's wrong, you're fine. That's your get-out-of-jail-free card. If you resolve it yourself and determine it's not a problem and you go on and you're wrong, then you're up into your knowingly and intentionally or recklessly or negligently. So ask. Debbie being wrong is much better for you than you being wrong. Yeah, no pressure, Debbie. Yeah. Yeah, Debbie isn't wrong. All right, the next topic that we have today is our open meeting law. Open meeting law is probably the thing that you get flogged with more than any other topic. You probably see this at league presentations. You get this during whatever training sessions you have on an annual or periodic basis. We do this for every community we have. We do it annually, and I include this in our Citizens Academy, too. I make sure they get a little bit of open meeting law seasoning so they see what's coming their way. The area that people struggle most with on the open meeting law is what is a public body. I can tell you, if you read that statute, it is hard to come up with a definition of what is not a public body. If it is an official group put together by this council, designated as a subcommittee, as a working group, or whatever the case may be, and this body officially appoints them, it is a public body. And you just need to presume that the open meeting law applies to them. There are working groups of council members in some communities that aren't officially appointed that will come back and report to the council on something. Probably okay as long as it's not a quorum. But if this body designates it as a subcommittee, even if there's only one of you on it, I think that's a public body and you need to follow the open meeting law. Well, that gives you some obvious problems when you're talking about subcommittees of three. It means you can't talk to each other at all. It's outside the public meeting. There's nothing you can discuss. That's troublesome for some people because you like to pick up the phone and bounce ideas around. But with subcommittees, you have to be very careful of that. Quasi-judicial body, the only one that you have that I know of, unless you have another appeals board that fits this group, is your Board of Adjustment. The reason why that's important is because the kind of discussion that they can have is even more limited because the decisions they render are typically reviewed by a court rather than by the council. So the quasi-judicial you don't have to worry about too much, but it pops up occasionally. One of the areas that we see violated the most, and you know, I don't really want to rat out clients, but we do see clients that fail in this capacity and we have to keep fixing things, is meeting notice, especially with your subcommittees. And it's not often with a council member-driven subcommittee. It's usually with an appointed subcommittee that doesn't have any council members on it at all and has a less prominent role. They like to be informal. Most of them are like-minded individuals who get together because they like being together and not necessarily because they're forced together. They like to have meetings at their houses and in coffee shops and in all kinds of places that just shouldn't happen. The meetings have to be posted 24 hours in advance. That is an absolute, other than emergency circumstances. And I can tell you, in the last 19 years that I've been representing cities and towns, I've seen maybe two true emergencies. And I'm thankful for that, because true emergencies mean things have gone really badly. But that shouldn't be something that pops up very often for you. The other thing you have to do, oh, I'm sorry, Councilmember.
Councilmember Luna.
So if you have a social gathering, let's say with one of our advisory groups, and they go meet and have dinner together, that needs to be posted?
It depends upon what they're doing, really. And this
sounds like they're eating.
Yeah, well, it's what they're doing while they're eating that's usually the
problem. Oh, okay.
I'll tell you, there are two different things I want to raise with this. One is, what are they really talking about, and what do people think they're talking about? What they're really talking about is likely what's going on in the neighborhood, you know, where they go for vacation, what the public who sees a group of them hanging out together thinks they're talking about is everything on the next agenda. For the council, P&Z, every committee in town, they think that they are talking about that. So what we typically will do is, if it's a social gathering where we know there'll be a quorum of a body that would be a public body under the statute, we notice it, and we just put on the notice that they're going to be meeting. There's no official agenda. There are no topics to be discussed, but they're going to be getting together in case you want to come watch.
Go ahead.
Even if it's at a private residence, does it have to be a public place? Does it have to be a restaurant of some type that's public?
Mr. Mayor, Councilmember, that is the area that causes the most consternation for most of our clients. But if that group is getting together at someone's house, that person has now invited the public into their house. And that isn't popular when we render that opinion, but that's the opinion we've given constantly. Because if that group is meeting in a non-public location, we already have a red flag in the air.
Red flag?
Yeah.
That's a neon light, red flag, and whatever.
And if the, even if it's just a social event, as soon as it goes behind the closed doors of someone's home, the perception of that meeting is that something is going on that people aren't supposed to see.
Well, how are they supposed to know if it's behind the closed door of private? Yeah, exactly. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
I want to give you a perfect example. I asked Debbie the other day. I have a picnic in a couple of weeks with a group I'm associated with, and I asked Debbie, I'd like to invite members of the council to do it. And again, she said, well, how many do you think will come? And she says, if you think, you know, three other people are going to come, the safest thing is to post it again because of that appearance. Because what happens at these events, you may be there for a social thing, but the other people who are there turn it into a city thing, because they'll come up and ask about city issues and events, and you end up pulled into that discussion. And I think that's why when we go on trips or conferences where more than three council members go, we post that as well. So it's always like, when in doubt, post. Right.
Yeah, and I might add, our clerk's office is very diligent in the city manager's office. Yeah. They track where there social events, any events where there may be four or more council members, and it is posted. So we do actively work towards that. That is the opinion of the Attorney General's office, who enforces the open meeting law, that even for social events or private events, if you're going to have a quorum of the council present or any body, it should be posted.
And I will tell you, Council, the probably one of the most fun moments I've had as a city attorney was a dinner at the mayor's house in Fountain Hills when the reporter came to dinner. And, of course, it's Fountain Hills, and the reporter's been there for 25 years, so everybody made him a plate and sat him down at the table, and it was fine. But
And the reporter took the dinner?
Oh, yeah. Sat down and had a meal with him.
Gary smiling. Well, that could lead into a whole other conflict of interest discussion.
And as you know, Mayor Nichols was the type that would have invited everybody on the street into his house as well and had a party for 400 people if they would all fit. So it really is that extreme. And I'll tell you that in addition to Debbie's experience with the open meeting law at the AG's office, they currently do not have a dedicated omelet team that enforces this. So these are now dispersed to all the poor folks around there. And if you get the unfortunate occurrence of having someone who is not busy at the moment, you're going to get a very thorough investigation. If you get someone who's very busy at the moment, it's going to take 5 years to get it resolved. And it's just the nature of the way that they have to operate now. It was a little more focused when they have more bodies down there, but like every other agency, they're pretty thin at the moment. All right, we're already into this slide. We have serious concerns about meeting at non-public locations. And again, you've invited the public into your house if you post a meeting for your house, which is fine if it's a committee where you think that people will come in and walk in the front door, you know, in a small community. But I got to tell you, a meeting publicly posted for one of your homes would be far too intimidating for the average citizen to think they could walk into, and the AG's office will have a problem with that. Most citizens won't walk up and say, you know, Councilmember Summers, thanks for the invitation. I'm going to come in and sit down on your couch and listen to the meeting. They're not happy with stuff like that. So that's the kind of thing that I think you need to be cognizant of when we're talking about them. Electronic or telephonic means, the mayor mentioned that we typically have somebody on the phone. We have those as permitted meetings in almost every instance now, mainly because of the way that you're all stretched and strained in the 20 different directions every day. It just sometimes is required, as long as the public can hear the discussion. So what we typically do in a venue like this that's wired for it is the public can hear you talk, they can hear your comments, you can hear the conversation yourself. As long as that's the case, you can have that kind of a meeting. You still got to stay on the agenda topics, and sometimes that's harder when you're not in the same room.
Councilman Luna?
What if you do something like with Google Hangout?
Oh, we'll get to that kind of meeting here in a moment. remember, you can't communicate with a quorum of the members of your body individually or as a group on anything that proposes legal action. Now, this is one of those areas where I think the AG gave us an opinion that didn't really help, because I think it confused the matter, but we'll talk about what legal action is here in a moment. So a quorum of this body is obviously 7 members, 4 is a quorum, 2 of 3 in a subcommittee, and if subcommittees have fewer than 3 of you on them, they still can have a quorum problem if there's even one of you, but the body has more people. Legal action is all deliberations. That means everything from beginning to end when you're talking about it. And the Attorney General's opinion on this is so broad that legal action should be anything that you think is going to lead to the final vote, regardless of what it is. Pitfalls, obviously.
So let's put that in layman's terms. So if there's an issue that's going to come up, any discussion related to that issue, related to the vote on that issue, the outcome of that issue, would fall under what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And even things that aren't discussions but are your opinion on that particular thing, when given to a quorum, will fall into that category.
I mean, if it's one person speaking and 5 people are listening, that's still the quorum. You don't have to have a two-way conversation.
Correct. That's correct.
Unilateral. Which will get into your email and other stuff like that, which is where it comes up often. Councilman Kavanaugh.
And I guess a classic challenge, many of us serve on other private nonprofit boards that have quorum requirements, but in terms of those operations, I've seen many times where you don't have a quorum, you're talking about the matters on your agenda, but you're holding the votes until your quorum maker shows up. And so you can't have that attitude for a public body, because you simply can, under the Attorney General's opinion, you simply cannot discuss that issue at all if a quorum is not present. Am I correct?
Well, Mr. Mayor and Councilmember Kavanaugh, that's a bit of a nuance that's an interesting topic, because the quorum not being present means that you're not addressing a quorum of the council and you're not violating the open meeting law. However, it depends upon how the information is being discussed and who can actually hear it. If a quorum is capable of hearing the message that's being sent out, for instance, if you're at one of those meetings where you have 4 people or 3 people and you need 4 and you're sending out an email to the fourth one, that's communicating with the quorum, even though they're not all in the same room. And now that we all have something at our desks or on the dais that allows us to communicate that way, that is a real possibility that a quorum can be present without sitting in the seats. And so I think it's a good cautionary note when you're talking about business before the council to not have those discussions until you have a quorum, but you probably won't have a technical violation. Polling is always one of the things that we hear complaints from citizens on the most, just because it's easy for someone to say, well, they already made up their mind before they came in the room. And you hear that complaint when someone witnesses an efficient council in action and a council that comes prepared, and you've read your materials, you've actually figured out what you want to ask as questions, and you have very few questions, and you're not having hours and hours of debate. People who are on the opposite side of a vote on that typically will be the ones to say, we've got a problem with this because you've already made up your minds. That's fine. You can come to every single council meeting with your mind made up on an issue as long as you're not talking about it amongst yourselves outside the meeting. So Councilmember Luna can say, Mayor, what do you think about this issue? Just to get an idea. He can talk to other members of the council. What he can't say is, Mayor, what do you think about this issue? I talked to the vice mayor, and here's what he thinks. The nuance there is one of them is just communication, one of them is polling. And if you're polling to try and make sure you have four votes before you come into the council chambers, the AG's office doesn't care for that.
Does the polling, you listed an example that's direct polling, one councilman to the other. What about indirect polling?
Indirect polling is also a problem, and it's it's commonly been referred to as the spokes on a wheel. You don't ever want to be the hub. You don't want to be the person who is receiving input that you are then communicating to a quorum. If you are just receiving input and you're hearing all of it as you do, there's no way for you to close yourself off to the information.
So using a third party to transmit that information is the same as speaking one to another.
Absolutely.
And counting votes or, in legislative parlance, whipping. You can't whip on a city council, basically.
That's correct. And frankly,
in other words, count votes, line up votes through either directly or through an independent party before you show up in the room. Is that what comes in with polling?
That is exactly what polling is in the AG's determinations. And they've been very strict on that.
Vice Mayor?
So I'm just kind of curious. I was waiting for that to come up. How can you can have in different levels of government whips that do that, help to organize, and not at this level? I'm curious the thought process behind that.
Because we didn't make the rule.
Mr. Mayor, Mr. Vice Mayor, the candid answer is because the law doesn't apply the same to them as it does to you.
Because we didn't make the rule.
The caucus process is exempted from the open meeting law. And so at a statewide level, they're allowed to go into caucus and to line up the votes and to whip people into shape and to get the votes in order before they come into the chamber. You're not allowed to do that.
As a follow-up then, so if I understand correctly, over my 5 years of being here, we're allowed to talk to two people because, as we look at an issue, I think that's kind of what we've done in the past to see, but we can't obviously make it a quorum. So what's your opinion on that? We're allowed to talk and see where people, you said a fine line that was kind of hard for me. The mayor or any of us can talk to another council member and say, hey, so what do you think about that? But not call it, how are you going to vote? Is that what you said? Or I kind of missed a little bit of that.
Mr. Mayor, Mr. Vice Mayor, that is the nuance that I raised. And I think that it's important for everyone to understand that you're not prohibited from talking with each other. You're prohibited from having a discussion about legal action with a quorum. So if you are talking to one another to just gauge opinion, but you're not communicating back and forth what you're going to vote or how you feel about that, you're just trying to figure out where you are.
I want to see that discussion.
Exactly.
Mayor, if I may jump in, that's why when we're talking or I'm talking with you, I say, you can talk to two others, which would give you three, but then you need to be very careful that you should not go to the fourth because it is nearly humanly impossible to draw and
or that those other that two go to another one because that
correct.
Then becomes a fourth.
Exactly. Correct.
So Councilman, go ahead, Vice Mayor.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Just as a follow-up, so that conversation that I have with two other people, is it the, hey, how do you feel about this, or how are you going to vote about this? So that's still, I'm a little unclear. I'm really trying to pull that out of you so I don't make this mistake in the future. But
if you are not communicating with a quorum of the council about legal action, then you are not violating the open meeting law. So if you never speak to more than just two people about the legal action, you can have whatever conversation you want. I don't recommend that because the next step is out of your control. Who they talk to after that is out of your control. So it is always better to try not to have those conversations outside of the council meetings, but I know that's impossible. So be clear in those communications not to impart, I'm going to vote one way or the other if you can avoid it. And be clear that when they go forth from that conversation, that they're not asking other members of this body what they're going to do.
And let me give you a specific example. And this is one that the Attorney General's office actually put into an opinion interpreting the open meeting law. The question was, how do you get an item on the agenda? And if the council wanted to say, I believe an item on the agenda should we have a traffic light at intersection A and B? That's okay. The council can talk among themselves, and it's not an open meeting law violation for you to say, I support putting this on the agenda. What is a violation is, hey, I've seen the accident reports or accident statistics. There's a lot of accidents at that intersection. We should place a traffic control device there to avoid accidents. I want it on the agenda. That's a violation of the open meeting law because you are giving your opinion.
You're advocating.
Yes, you're advocating. Saying that I want it on the agenda is not a violation of the open meeting law. Saying why you want it on the agenda is a violation of the open meeting law.
Just quick last.
Go ahead.
An observation that I've seen or a phrase that works that I've seen over the years in council is, hey, I've already talked to two people. Mm-hmm. I can't talk to you on this issue. If I felt like it was someone advocating or saying, hey, I'm going to go a route, is that still a good phrase to use or a good way to approach it?
It is always a good thing to do to remind your fellow council members that you've already had a conversation that is at the limit of what is not a quorum. I think that telling them, if you go forward and talk about this with more than with anybody else, then we've also, you know, drawn them into the conversation and we violated the quorum rule. That really is the challenge. And nobody's naive enough to think that you're not going to be having discussions outside the meeting. But if you keep it to less than a quorum at all times, you're safe, as long as that person doesn't trail off and create a quorum for you.
Councilman Kavanaugh.
Good. I'd like to give you another law school hypothetical, but we all serve on council subcommittees, which have minutes, and council subcommittees take actions. For example, we will review the minutes, and that committee has discussed a certain issue, and the vote might be 2-1. So I know where those council members' votes are. I haven't talked to them about it, but it's there in the minutes that are available for the public. I can still go and talk to other council members, two other council members, because I haven't talked to those people on that committee. I know what their vote is from their committee action, but I can still go and say, what do you think about this issue to two other council members, correct?
Mr. Mayor, Councilmember Kavanaugh, I think that's not technically a violation because mainly those folks who voted one way in subcommittee are not bound by their next vote, and you're not certain of what they're going to do, so that you don't have that absolute certainty that you've now polled and have it. Well, you don't really have a certainty of polling anyway, but
right.
I think that is that's a good example of a non-technical violation that you still need to be very careful with, because if viewed with a different angle, it might be viewed as problematic from some of our more aggressive folks who handle
right. Any other variation on that is that other council members have spoken to the press on an issue, and Gary's written a story, and I know that two council members are opposed to whatever, having traffic signals. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've read about it. It's public. Again, I think, isn't that one of those situations where it's not a technical violation right. to talk to other members of the council?
Mr. Mayor, I would agree that's not a technical violation.
Right.
Councilor Summers?
This is bound to come up anyway, but what about the social media issues? We all have Facebook pages, and we all have Twitter accounts, and somebody actually uses Google that isn't working for Google.
we'll get to that whole section here in a moment, but I think that it starts off a conversation that we typically, this slide used to end, which is email. Because email used to be the thing that caused.
Can we get back? Because I want to wrap up the polling and everything. So if, I guess the bottom line is whether in because we're talking about little nuances here and inadvertent things. But the idea that any of us would go around and try and round up or count or whatever votes prior to a meeting is whatever method you use about that. If your intent is to do that, I what I'm hearing is. Just don't do that. Right? Is that accurate?
Absolutely, Mayor. And I think what you're highlighting is the fundamental root of the open meeting law, that all meetings are intended to be public. And that if there's any interpretation under the open meeting law to be made, it's to be made in favor of public disclosure.
Okay.
And so that
if you have a doubt, exactly. If you have a doubt, your counsel would be.
If you have
a setup, by the way, okay?
Exactly.
If you have a doubt,
then it is open. If you have a doubt, assume that whatever you're doubting is probably not okay with the law.
Okay.
All right. The obvious potential problems. Councilmember Summers set.
Well, I'm
this
sorry.
One up.
You skipped email.
Well, email is right in this group.
Okay.
Email is our historic problem because everybody loved reply all. That button killed me in the first few years that people didn't recognize there was a difference. Because it would be, hey, this is a great idea, reply all. Now, 7 plus the manager and the attorney and everybody else are involved in this. Reply all, in my mind, is something you should never use in council communications, just to be safe. Even if it's just, hey, are you available for a meeting tomorrow morning at 7? Just because you don't know how far that conversation will go, because someone might reply all with a nuance that is now something that is legal action, and now we've got this chain of discussion going on. So reply all, please, just don't use it.
Vice Mayor?
So recently we've had some examples. A citizen writes in a complaint that's very general, very upset about something. A particular council member, whosever area that might be, will reply to them and let the rest of the council know, maybe through the council assistant. Sometimes it's a reply all, but I think they're genuinely trying to say, hey, I've got this, let me take care of this so we don't have multiple responses. Do you think that's appropriate, or are we having that challenge?
I think that's a challenge, frankly, because the content of that citizen's complaint might be something that's legal action under the law. And you won't know until you see that particular one. So if your response is to reply all, I've got this covered, and you send a message to the council, and I'm sure all of you probably have a group, that's just the council members, send to the manager, say, look, I've got this covered, I want to talk to the citizen, Chris, what are you doing about this? Those kinds of things you can communicate, and he can communicate to everyone else. Or you can send to the council, I have this covered. But still, that could spawn those additional conversations. So it's better to allow the city manager to reply to the rest of the council to tell everyone we're working on this and to communicate with him as well, or to communicate with the city attorney. I think communicating that to the whole group is challenging.
As a follow-up, we rarely do that with the city manager. These are pretty council assistant low-level communications. I don't think we'd take, hey, I'm mad about that speed bump or something, all the way up to the city manager. That's still okay? I mean, that's how we do it.
And I think what Andrew's saying, if you just say, I will respond to the citizen, that isn't an open meeting law violation because you are not telling them how you're going to respond. The challenge is if you do the reply all, I'm responding, then you don't know. Well, then Councilmember Richin says, well, make sure you tell them this, or Councilmember Luna, make sure, and then you are encouraging the ongoing reply all, which can lead to problems. Your simple response, I will respond to this citizen, in and of itself is not an open meeting law violation.
And I'm happy to hear that your city manager doesn't have to deal with speed bumps. He's probably one of the few that doesn't.
Yeah, we got him working on big stuff.
As the unfortunate thing of being in a larger city, you all probably have the grocery store rule more than anyone else. You're on television, so they know your faces, and they find you in the grocery store. I don't think your manager
Luna?
Gets to escape that.
What happens if you mess up? You hit reply all, and you go, that's against the open meeting law. Do I run to Debbie and tell her, I what?
Like, I think you do exactly that, Councilmember Luna. If you send a message to Debbie and say, look, I just hit reply on this, didn't intend to, what do you want me to do? Then she can be aware of it and keep an eye on what's going on. But really, the open meeting law is that violations are cured by subsequent action, and there's no way to cure that. There's no way to undo it. It's kind of like ringing a bell. You just can't go back from it. So let her know. There's probably nothing to be done, but at least then it's on everybody's radar in case that topic
comes. Yeah, and so everyone knows the kind of communications that really that the Vice Mayor and everyone were talking about that we get aren't even about speed bumps, because those are pretty clear. If someone says this traffic light doesn't work or speed bump, then it is sort of a default into whosever district it is. But it would be a general statement, like, you know, you guys are all a bunch of idiots. You know, matters of truth, in other words. And, you know, it's really just maybe or a rambling thing, and someone will answer, or a question on a general nature, you know, which you couldn't tie to a specific district or a specific thing. It's just somebody who's disgruntled, and they make some kind of a comment like that. I think that's where it gets into where you want to answer, and you want to let everybody else know that you're answering. And it's not an agenda item. It could evolve into a general agenda. I mean, I think that's what you're talking about. Someone talks about, for example, you're wasting money by doing this. Well, you know, I mean, I could see that evolving into a budget discussion, which we take formal action on. But that's where it comes up that I think people are, that I've seen, the council members, and I'm real tempted. Someone has a smarmy comment coming in, you want to have something go back, you want to let everyone else know, you know, here's how I answer this. And it's just really tempting to not say reply all. That's where, am I missing that? That's where it really comes up, is when you get those kind of.
He's talking about me. I'm famous for snarky replies to constituents. So.
And we love them.
They're entertaining, apparently. So from now on, I won't be hitting reply all. I'm so sorry.
Is there a Dave exception?
To my colleagues for.
You know, Mayor, that by nature, all of you are here because you want to respond to the public. So it is inherently challenging to not reply all. I understand that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the frustrating thing, is that, and when I say frustrating, because it's not, there are some conversations taken in context really have very little to do with specific actions. But I get it that you can't, it's really hard to draw that line. And so what the law says is, since we can't draw that line for every instance, we're going to cast a wide shadow and just stay away from it. And that way you won't come close to crossing the line.
That's a great summary of it.
Okay.
The other issue that we've had is a little bit less of a problem, mainly because records of it are hard to track, is the instant messaging. Now, if anyone on the council or anyone who's listening to this thinks that your instant messages go away when they're deleted, they don't. There is a record of them that can be retrieved, and if we are requested to get those records from our vendors, we have to do it. And so under the very broad public records laws in the state, presume that everything that's in an IM is also just like it was in an email. They don't go away. There's a period of time in which they're going to be retrievable, and particularly with our electronic requirements when we have litigation holds that we have to put on things, you wouldn't believe the volume of electronic communications we have to preserve on a daily basis. Blogs, you know, Facebook, any of those things, the only way those are okay as a meeting is with notice, agenda, and a minute, and minutes, and we'll get to that. That's another AG's opinion on the next slide. The not-so-obvious problems we've already talked about. This is the spokes on a wheel. We don't want to be the hub. Circulation by citizen. This one caught one of my council members by surprise at one point when the council member thought she was having a one-on-one conversation with a citizen, when what she was really having was a one-on-one conversation with the citizen and six other members of the council who the citizen was communicating with on the same one-on-one basis. So the citizen was the hub and nobody else knew it. But by the time it got to the meeting, everybody knew where everybody else's vote was. And that was a problem. And so that's something you need to be aware of, that your one-on-one communication with a citizen also might be going to others. There might be a reply all out to the rest of the council. Just be aware of it. There's nothing you can really do about that except to tell citizens, please don't communicate my views with other members of the council. That's for public. Some cities have gone to a little blurb at the bottom of their email, and sometimes those things are just getting bigger and bigger of all the warnings about the email, which makes them completely useless after a while. I think the only one people see is the logo, you know, the big logo sticking out there.
Hey, Councilor Summers?
Well, on that, for social media, if we follow each other on social media, which I think we probably all do or pretty close, and we start tweeting out, I'm voting no on this issue, then everybody knows how I'm voting. If everybody else starts to do that, then we have the same problem. Should we even follow each other on Twitter? Should we be tweeting stuff like that out? Facebook?
Mr. Mayor, Councilmember Summers, I don't think you should be tweeting that out, particularly at council meetings, because I think then you do have that problem. It's kind of like the note pass.
Wait, wait. You said you don't think she'd be tweeting that out at council meetings.
At council meetings.
Well, isn't the problem, you're already in a public setting, isn't the problem outside of council meetings?
It is both. But I think that the time period in which we're talking about that's the most problematic is before the meeting and leading up to all those discussions. But at the meeting also is a concern, just because it's kind of the equivalent of holding a sign up and telling, you know, the person across the dais how you're going to vote.
But isn't that what we do during a meeting anyway?
Once you vote, yeah, or once you talk, once you speak publicly about it. I can tell you in the appearance of impropriety world, the note passing on the dais, you could be saying, where do you want to go to dinner tomorrow? And if members of the public sitting in the audience swear that you are pulling votes up there. So if you were tweeting from the dais, I think they would feel the same way. But I think you've hit on a very...
And yet tweets are public.
They're public and they're out there in the world, but so is email. And the AG has had a problem with email that is unilaterally distributed.
Well, I can't access, just to pick one, Chris Glover's email. I mean, you'd have to actually go do a public record request, but all I have to do is have a phone or a computer or access to a computer, and I can get his tweets.
Absolutely.
We could be having a public meeting. Of course, it's not agendized.
Yeah, let me jump in a little bit and start with this is social media is an area of the law that has gotten ahead of or an area that has gotten ahead of the law. So the Attorney General's office hasn't done a whole lot in terms of interpreting how does this work. Very stressful for city attorneys in terms of advice we give. So we have to give you advice to be careful, and you're allowed to talk to the media because the council and elected officials, you have the same First Amendment rights as any other citizen. So that's why you're allowed to tell the media, I support this position that's coming to the council, and that can be printed in the paper so that all of you can see how one another feels on that. So the question is social media more analogous to talking to the press, or is it more analogous to emails? And we don't have any law interpreting that.
It's Twitter. I think, you know, common sense prevails. If you're on Facebook and you can accept friends, to me, that's a closed group. If I talk to the paper, it's not a closed group because anybody can access that. But it's a closed group if I have a Facebook account that isn't open to anybody, everybody at the same time. And so to me, that's a very absolute line. Which is why I don't follow you on Facebook. You know, I don't. And because to me...
I don't follow you either.
Well, you shouldn't. I don't think you should on Facebook. But although on mine, I don't have friends. I have likes. So anybody could go on and get into my Facebook.
Yeah.
Which is different than if I have to accept you as a friend. Because I can close the group if I accept you as a friend.
And Mayor, that's why I believe all of you that have a city Facebook, anyone can follow you.
Because if you're a public official, then that's one reason why Facebook does it, I believe. You can't have a friend if you're a public official. It's all likes, which means anyone can go on and like you, and they have access to your Facebook account.
Well, and Mr. Mayor, I think the reason why this is such a dangerous area, and particularly in Facebook when you're posting on there what your view may be, and that's typically what Facebook's about, is it really is hard to draw a distinction between a post on Facebook or a tweet and the email unilaterally communicated that the AG's already said is wrong.
So, yeah, because I could use a public forum. Whether Facebook's a public forum, but I could certainly use that and mask a private conversation. Oh, just because 5,000 people heard it, it wasn't private. Well, you know, there's easy ways to do that.
Right.
In a newspaper, I don't control the content. You know, once I give an interview or do that, or even if I write an op-ed, they can edit it, they can do whatever. And the AG's said we can do that because that's communicating with the public as a whole. But I see where you're coming from as far as Facebook.
Well, and that's why we have the slide on the selected AG opinions, because I defy anyone to draw any real pattern in these opinions, because the AG is in the exact same position we are. They're reacting to different forms of creative ways of people getting around the open meeting law that come up, or they're reacting to citizens who have raised an issue nobody's ever thought about before. The one that Debbie brought up before is unilateral communications with a quorum, even if nobody ever responds on a legal action, are prohibited. And this is, I keep wanting to say a few years ago, it's probably about 10 years ago now this opinion came out, where the traffic signal example is one of the examples given in the AG's opinion. And it's, I'm concerned about public safety in the community is okay. I want a traffic signal at this location is not okay.
Right.
And that kind of nuance is pretty tough to deal with when you're just out in public talking about topics. What happened from that is that we said as city attorneys, well, wait a minute, that means you can't go and talk to the media, because if you're talking to the media, you are talking to a quorum of the council unilaterally about a topic that's legal action. And we said, whoa, wait a minute, that can't work. One of our colleagues got sideways with her counsel over that and, you know, ended up in a different career because of it. Shortly following that, Councilmember Kavanaugh ran a bill that brought into the statute the carve-out that it's okay to communicate through the media. Now, to me, the nuance there, yeah, different Kavanaugh.
Yeah, thank you.
Spelled differently, too.
Political leanings, though.
It's hard to differentiate.
Oh, I'm going to leave that one alone. His wife is one
you
of
look like twins.
So I think that nuance is a distinction without a difference. I don't think that there's much difference there, but the law says there is, so we're going to allow for that. And it just makes practical sense. I think it just highlights the impractical nature of the prior opinion. But at least we have that carve-out now. You can talk to the media. Blog meetings, the natural extension of this is, okay, if a unilateral communication can be a meeting and a violation, then we must be able to have blog meetings. We must be able to have everybody log on to a site and type in their comments, and that's the meeting, and people can look on and view it all day. So we have an AG's opinion that says that's okay. I can't think of a more horrifyingly boring thing than tuning into a council blog meeting. To me, that just seems like that would be terrible. Now, what scares me the most about this AG opinion, though, is if councils decided that was a good idea to have a blog meeting, the filter that people have when they come to your dais and they're standing in front of the camera is very different than the filter they have when they're sitting at home. So I would be concerned about the kind of public discourse you would have in a blog meeting. So I've always recommended, please don't have those.
People actually do that? Blog meetings, so they've actually have done that?
I've had questions on whether or not they could do it on some
But did they actually ever go ahead and do it?
No. I threw myself in front of that bus because there was no way that I would want to try and monitor how that would happen. Executive sessions, you only have 7 reasons you can go into executive session. Remember, the open meeting law says all meetings are to be open except for these 7 things, and they're all pretty simple. Employment of people you appoint. Remember, it's just of people you appoint. You can't go into executive session to talk about an employee you don't have appointment power over. And that is something that council members who are engaged with departments want to do, and it really is not okay. Records exempt from law disclosure by law. I have yet to see one of those in 19 years of representing multiple communities. It just doesn't happen. Legal advice is very common to go in there. You should have the opportunity to talk to your lawyers about things before you get into trouble. Contract negotiations and litigation. There are a few times that you're able to give direction in e-session. Litigation is one of them. However, there is an Arizona case that says, no, you can't give direction. So the nuance I think we've drawn from the Tempe case is that you're not allowed to give direction on the final resolution of anything in the e-session. You can't tell your lawyers, go settle this thing. You can tell them, this is what it would take to settle this thing, and then they'll be back in front of you with a public item to actually take that action. You can talk with your lawyers about legal strategy. You can talk about what are your ranges in negotiating a settlement. Obviously, those things can't be done in public, because if you come back into public and say, all right, Debbie, go negotiate, but don't go any higher than $300,000, well, you just settled your case for $300,000. So that kind of discussion, it has to be very nuanced. It has to be very well controlled by your city attorney. And I'm confident that you don't have problems with that when you're with her in the room.
And I would just, our charter is a little different, because most charters say over X amount for litigation purposes, it would have to come back to the public meeting. Our charter does not require that. So Andrew's correct. There is a nuance. You can't give direction to settle for X amount. You can say you have authority to settle up to, and then it's left to the litigators to negotiate a settlement up to X amount.
Labor union discussions, I've yet to see that one, thankfully. That's a challenge. International, interstate, or tribal matters, we've done that one time where we had tribal council members behind closed doors. And real estate, I'm sure you've had a couple of those conversations in the session. Remember, and this is one I stole from one of my partners, Chris Schmaltz, because I think it's a great way to describe it. You can't use an e-session to just talk in private about something that is embarrassing or uncomfortable. These are limited to the seven categories, and they're not there for the purpose of avoiding embarrassment. They're there for the purpose of giving you those few times where it's okay for you not to talk in the public eye. If it's messy or uncomfortable, sorry, but sometimes that has to be out in the public. It has to be confined to a specific agenda matter. Now, that's a little tricky, because you can't really spell out a clear agenda like you do on your regular work agendas that you see. It'll say a lot of things about what you're going to be talking about. Obviously, you can't put too much information in an e-session agenda, but it has to be limited to whatever you put in there. They're private but not secret. I think that's a good succinct way to talk to describe it. Don't hold one without your attorney president. I really wish I didn't have to put that in the slide, but experience has told me I have to put that in the slide. And there are serious penalties if you disclose anything that was provided to you in e-session, so try to avoid doing that as well. Meeting minutes, summary of actions, pretty clear. Required even for subcommittees. This has been a real problem with most of our clients, because the subcommittees weren't doing a great job of taking minutes on the smaller subcommittees, and the staff members, as their staffs got smaller and smaller and smaller, now there are fewer people to take the minutes. I don't know if Mesa puts all of them online, but most of our committees put all of our subcommittee meeting minutes online. We did. Yeah, I'm getting the nod, yes. So that's why it's important to make sure you have them. It's got to have a summary of the action. It's got to be posted on the website for you all. And it's required by law. Violations of the open meeting law, unlike our conflicts of interest, are void. You cannot have we're going to go forward even though there's a violation. There's a $500 civil penalty to each one of you for those actions, and you're limited in defense of yourself unless you vote in a public meeting to defend yourself, which when you've had an open meeting violation is an uncomfortable thing to do, I can tell you. If you knowingly violate, you can be removed from office, but again, I haven't seen that. Hopefully never will. I got another 20 years here, so I'm good halfway through so far. It's enforced by OMLET. We've talked about them before, the Open Meeting Law Enforcement Team. It's kind of a misnomer now. It's not really a team anymore, but they do get together and talk about the results occasionally. But they are narrow in their interpretation. Liability, just remember, you're an agent of the city. In some instances, you can be considered that. Your actions can lead to liability. You don't want to assume you have immunity for it, because in some cases, people can raise some pretty good arguments that you don't. So ask Debbie before you do anything crazy. Don't ever ask a liability-creating question in public, is my response. It's a later slide, but I think this is a good spot to put it there. And I put this in caps because some people forget that the minutes are public records. And what you say verbally and when you see it in writing may not be exactly what you thought they were. They may not be identical, often aren't. Most of us, when we see our spoken text in writing, are surprised at how illiterate we sound. And it's just the way it is.
I ain't never none filled that way about anything. not me, no.
What's really important, though, and I tell council members this, and I know that you're all busy, but please review the minutes for accuracy. Because it's bad enough if it didn't quite come across the way you thought it did. It's even worse if it's not accurate. and each council member is usually keenly aware of what they said. And if you think it's wrong, contact the clerk. They'll go back, they'll listen to the tape, they'll watch the video, they'll figure out if it's right or wrong. And if a change needs to be made, they'll make it. But most often it's not wrong, because they usually get it right. There's my ask liability creating questions before you get in the meeting. It's not the best time to get legal advice in a meeting. I know there are some times where you really want to have your lawyer give you an opinion in a meeting. We hate doing that, by the way. We'd rather give you an opinion like every other lawyer in the world gets to do privately rather than having to do it in public, but we know we live in a fishbowl. But if you get this timeout signal from your attorney, that means you need to stop talking now. If you get waved arms, it means it's already too late. And if they break in on the microphone, it means we're down a road we don't want to be down. I have that signal system with all of my elected officials. And now, you know, the lights, it makes me laugh a little bit, because now in a couple of council chambers, we have that light. I hit that light, and there's never a response. Still, the timeout gets me the response that I need. Contact with press and attorneys, obviously, it's best if you have consistency. So we usually advise that you go through whoever the staff liaison is, whether that's someone from the manager's office, the attorney's office in litigation, whoever it is that handles that. The reason for that is that it's hard for the seven of you to know the whole story unless you've all been engaged in the whole story. They probably have information that you don't. It's better if we have someone with the whole picture responding, but I know you're going to get questions from the press, and you know, you're only speaking for yourself. You can't speak for the city when you speak to the press. It's best bet if you don't know thoroughly what they're asking you to just say, you know, no, I'd rather not comment on it right now. Let me get back with you. Because it's much better to get back with an informed opinion than it is to give an opinion that isn't informed, and then to have staff come up to you later and say, hey, you know, I hate to tell you this, but what you said wasn't accurate. Those are hard to go back from. And so we usually say, make sure that there's someone that you can go to who you know is going to have the whole story for you. In summary, it's pretty simple. Don't get cute with the conflicts. They're just way too severe in the penalties. Removal from office, I think, is pretty bad. But class six felony is pretty bad, too. Presume everything you say and do will be distributed publicly. I think there's no greater time than now, and Lord knows where it's going to go from here. But right now, people have such an ability to distribute what you've done and said in edited versions of it, little YouTube videos. We've already seen that from council chambers, the view of someone sitting over my shoulder of one of you cut and pasted and thrown on YouTube, and we don't really like to go there. So remember, that's always the case, and omelets aren't for breakfast, although sometimes they feel like they are.
Great. Any questions? Oh, sorry. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate
pleasure.
It.
Excellent.
Thank Let's you do this again.
About once a year is what we usually do.
Next time, bring the Novocaine, okay? Thank you. Item number two. Acknowledge receipt of minutes of various boards and committees. A motion from Councilmember Kavanaugh, or Glover, sorry about that. Second, Councilmember Luner. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Hear reports on meetings and conferences attended. Councilman Richens.
On Monday, I had the opportunity to attend the National Recreation and Parks Association Conference in Houston with Mark Hirschberg and a couple other folks from the Parks Department, where they received national accreditation for our Parks and Recreation programs. It's a significant honor. I think there's only four cities in Arizona that have this accreditation, and just wanted to give some congratulations to our Parks and Recreation Department for a job well done. The accreditation involves thinking through a lot of things about your programs, how they're delivered, how you're developing leadership in your department, and Mark did a great job with many of the folks on his staff to get it to that point. So, thanks.
Thank you. Councilmember Glover.
I had a business roundtable meeting with the mayor yesterday. It was very well attended, so I want to thank the Chamber of Commerce and for all those that attended yesterday.
Okay, good turnout. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
I had a town hall the night before for Southwest Mesa, and we had a great turnout in District 3 and a very lively discussion.
Thank you, and we're going to continue this with other. I really like the joint thing, meetings. Gives you a chance to talk to your council member and to me, and it's it's been a great format so far.
And we don't
so
violate the open meeting law.
And we don't, because there's just two of us. But we really, I really appreciate Council Members Glover and Kavanaugh for jointly sponsoring these town halls. It's been a nice change in pace, and I think the citizens appreciate having both their council member and the mayor there to talk about things of importance. We got another one coming up with the vice mayor next week.
Yeah, I haven't looked.
I think it's next week. This is a good one. It's for youth, mainly high school age, which last year was very successful, and we're looking for having a success. And then we have another little thing next month with, or later this month with Councilmember Luna out in his district. Okay, good. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a reminder, today we have the opening of the Fiesta Station. We have an open house from 5 to 7, so we invite the public to come out and have tours of the of this building. So we're excited about that happening today. Also want to remind everyone, this weekend we have our appliance and computers recycling event. So that'll be, make sure I'm saying it right, yeah, this Saturday from 8 to noon at the East Mesa Service Center. We invite everybody out to that. And also, Mayor, you just mentioned this, that your Tuesday, October 15th from 5:30 to 7 is the Mayor Smith's Youth Pizza Town Hall with the Vice Mayor. And it'll be at the Arizona Museum of Natural History at the rooftop terrace. So we invite everybody out to that at 5:30, October 15th.
And when we say Pizza Town Hall, we're not going to talk about pizza.
Oh.
We're going to serve pizza.
Okay.
So there will be plenty of good eats, dinner, and then we'll talk about things. And what's good about this youth thing, like most town halls, we spend most of the time answering questions, and it's really interesting to have the high school kids ask questions about their community. Oftentimes, they ask the most challenging questions because they're not, they don't feel any boundaries, and that's why I enjoy it. So get ready, Vice Mayor.
I'm ready. Yeah.
it's pretty fun because boy, they don't hold anything back. They'll ask, and the other thing is they expect direct answers. They don't appreciate the runaround. So it's a lot of fun to go to. Okay, I have a motion to adjourn, Councilman Richens, second from Councilmember Kavanaugh. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you.